horrors, nothing at all. Then there is a high incentive to park there rather than to park a little farther away and walk. So everybody tries to park there, but most of them find the spaces are already full. And people end up wasting time and burning fossil fuel as they cruise for a spot. Shoup's solution involves installing digital parking meters that are capable of adaptive prices that rise with demand. This has now been implemented in downtown San Francisco. The prices are set with a target occupancy rate in mind, and Shoup argues that this rate should be somewhere around 85%, a radical drop from the nearly 100% packed curbs of most major cities. As he notes, when occupancy goes from 90% to 95%, it accommodates only 5% more cars, but doubles the length of everyone's search. The key impact that occupancy rate has on parking strategy becomes clear once we recognize that parking is an optimal stopping problem. As you drive along the street, every time you see the occasional empty spot, you have to make a decision. Should you take this spot or go a little closer to your destination and try your luck? Assume you're on an infinitely long road with parking spots evenly spaced, and your goal is to minimize the distance you end up walking to your destination. Then the solution is the look-then-leap rule. The optimally stopping driver should pass up all vacant spots occurring more than a certain distance from the destination, and then take the first space that appears thereafter. And the distance at which to switch from looking to leaping depends on the proportion of spots that are likely to be filled, the occupancy rate. If this infinite street has a big city occupancy rate of 99%, with just 1% of spots vacant, then you should take the first spot you see, starting at almost 70 spots, more than a quarter mile, from your destination. But if Shoup has his way and occupancy rates drop to just 85%, you don't need to start seriously looking until you're half a block away. Most of us don't drive on perfectly straight, infinitely long roads. So as with other optimal stopping problems, researchers have considered a variety of tweaks to this basic scenario. For instance, they've studied the optimal parking strategy for cases where the driver can make U-turns, where fewer parking spaces are available the closer one gets to the destination, and where the driver is in competition against rival drivers also heading to the same destination. But whatever the exact parameters of the problem, more vacant spots are always going to make life easier. It's something of a policy reminder to municipal governments. Parking is not as simple as having a resource, spots, and maximizing its utilization, occupancy. Parking is also a process, an optimal stopping problem. And it's one that consumes attention, time, and fuel, and generates both pollution and congestion. The right policy addresses the whole problem. And, counterintuitively, empty spots on highly desirable blocks can be the sign that things are working correctly. We asked Shoup if his research allows him to optimize his own commute through the Los Angeles traffic to his office at UCLA. Does arguably the world's top expert on parking have some kind of secret weapon? He does. I ride my bike. When to quit. In 1997, Forbes magazine identified Boris Berezovsky as the richest man in Russia, with a fortune of roughly $3 billion. Just 10 years earlier, he had been living on a mathematician's salary from the USSR Academy of Sciences. He made his billions by drawing on industrial relationships he'd formed through his research to found a company that facilitated interaction between foreign car makers and the Soviet car manufacturer Avtovaz. Berezovsky's company then became a large-scale dealer for the cars that Avtovaz produced, using a payment installment scheme to take advantage of hyperinflation in the ruble. Using the funds from this partnership, he bought partial ownership of Avtovaz itself, then the ORT television network, and finally the Sibneft oil company. Becoming one of a new class of oligarchs, he participated in politics, supporting Boris Yeltsin's re-election in 1996 and the choice of Vladimir Putin as his successor in 1999. But that's when Berezovsky's luck turned. Shortly after Putin's election, Berezovsky publicly objected to proposed constitutional reforms that would expand the power of the president. His continued public criticism of Putin led to the deterioration of their relationship. In October 2000, when Putin was asked about Berezovsky's criticisms, he replied, "The state has a cudgel in its hands that you use to hit just once, but on the head. We haven't used this cudgel yet. The day we get really angry, we won't hesitate." Berezovsky left Russia permanently the next month, taking up exile in England, where he continued to criticize Putin's regime. How did Berezovsky decide it was time to leave Russia? Is there a way, perhaps, to think mathematically about the advice to quit while you're ahead? Berezovsky, in particular, might have considered this very question himself, since the topic he had worked on all those years ago as a mathematician was none other than optimal stopping. He authored the first, and so far the only book, entirely devoted to the secretary problem. The problem of quitting while you're ahead has been analyzed under several different guises, but perhaps the most appropriate to Berezovsky's case, with apologies to Russian oligarchs, is known as the burglar problem. In this problem, a burglar has the opportunity to carry out a sequence of robberies. Each robbery provides some reward, and there's a chance of getting away with it each time. But if the burglar is caught, he gets arrested and loses all his accumulated gains. What algorithm should he follow to maximize his expected take? The fact that this problem has a solution is bad news for heist movie screenplays. When the team is trying to lure the old burglar out of retirement for one last job, the canny thief need only crunch the numbers. Moreover, the results are pretty intuitive. The number of robberies you should carry out is roughly equal to the chance you get away, divided by the chance you get caught. If you're a skilled burglar and have a 90% chance of pulling off each robbery, and a 10% chance of losing it all, then retire after 90 divided by 10, or 9 robberies. A ham-fisted amateur with a 50-50 chance of success? The first time you have nothing to lose, but don't push your luck more than once. Despite his expertise in optimal stopping, Berezovsky's story ends sadly. He died in March 2013, found by a bodyguard in the locked bathroom of his house in Berkshire, with a ligature around his neck. The official conclusion of a post-mortem examination was that he had committed suicide, hanging himself after losing much of his wealth through a series of high-profile legal cases involving his enemies in Russia. Perhaps he should have stopped sooner, amassing just a few tens of millions of dollars, say, and not getting into politics. But alas, that was not his style. One of his mathematician friends, Leonid Boguslavsky, told a story about Berezovsky from when they were both young researchers, on a water skiing trip to a lake near Moscow. The boat they had planned to use broke down. Here's how David Hoffman tells it in his book, The Oligarchs. While their friends went to the beach and lit a bonfire, Boguslavsky and Berezovsky headed to the dock to try to repair the motor. 3 hours later, they had taken apart and reassembled the motor. It was still dead. They had missed most of the party, yet Berezovsky insisted they had to keep trying. "We tried this and that," Boguslavsky recalled. Berezovsky would not give up. Surprisingly, not giving up, ever, also makes an appearance in the optimal stopping literature. It might not seem like it from the wide range of problems we have discussed, but there are sequential decision-making problems for which there is no optimal stopping rule. A simple example is the game of Triple or Nothing. Imagine you have a dollar and can play the following game as many times as you want. Bet all of your money and have a 50% chance of receiving triple the amount and a 50% chance of losing your entire stake. How many times should you play? Despite its simplicity, there is no optimal stopping rule for this problem, since each time you play, your average gains are a little higher. Starting with a dollar, you will get $3 half the time and nothing half the time. So on average, you will expect to end the first round with $1.50 in your pocket. Then, if you were lucky in the first round, the two possibilities from the $3 you've just won are $9 and $0, for an average return of $4.50 from the second bet. The math shows that you should always keep playing. But if you follow this strategy, you will eventually lose everything. Some problems are better avoided than solved. Always be stopping. I expect to pass through this world but once. Any good, therefore, that I can do, or any kindness that I can show to any fellow creature, let me do it now. Let me not defer or neglect it, for I shall not pass this way again. Stephen Grillet. Spend the afternoon. You can't take it with you. Annie Dillard. We've looked at specific cases of people confronting optimal stopping problems in their lives, and it's clear that most of us encounter these kinds of problems in one form or another daily. Whether it involves secretaries, fiancés, or apartments, life is full of optimal stopping. So the irresistible question is whether, by evolution or education or intuition, we actually do follow the best strategies. At first glance, the answer is no. About a dozen studies have produced the same result. People tend to stop early, leaving better applicants unseen. To get a better sense for these findings, we talked to UC Riverside's Amnon Rappaport, who's been running optimal stopping experiments in the laboratory for more than 40 years. The study that most closely follows the classical secretary problem was run in the 1990s by Rappaport and his collaborator Daryl Seal. In this study, people went through numerous repetitions of the secretary problem with either 40 or 80 applicants each time. The overall rate at which people found the best possible applicant was pretty good, about 31%. Not far from the optimal 37%. Most people acted in a way that was consistent with the look-then-leap rule, but they leapt sooner than they should have, more than 4/5 of the time. Rappaport told us that he keeps this in mind when solving optimal stopping problems in his own life. In searching for an apartment, for instance, he fights his own urge to commit quickly. Despite the fact that by nature I am very impatient and I want to take the first apartment, I try to control myself. But that impatience suggests another consideration that isn't taken into account in the classical secretary problem, the role of time. After all, the whole time you're searching for a secretary, you don't have a secretary. What's more, you're spending the day conducting interviews instead of getting your own work done. This type of cost offers a potential explanation for why people stop early when solving a secretary problem in the lab. Seal and Rappaport showed that if the cost of seeing each applicant is imagined to be, for instance, 1% of the value of finding the best secretary, then the optimal strategy would perfectly align with where people actually switched from looking to leaping in their experiment. The mystery is that in Seal and Rappaport's study, there wasn't a cost for search. So why might people in the laboratory be acting like there was one? Because for people, there's always a time cost. It doesn't come from the design of the experiment. It comes from people's lives. The endogenous time costs of searching, which aren't usually captured by optimal stopping models, might thus provide an explanation for why human decision-making routinely diverges from the prescriptions of those models. As Optimal Stopping researcher Neil Bearden puts it, after searching for a while, we humans just tend to get bored. It's not irrational to get bored, but it's hard to model that rigorously. But this doesn't make optimal stopping problems less important. It actually makes them more important, because the flow of time turns all decision-making into optimal stopping. The theory of optimal stopping is concerned with the problem of choosing a time to take a given action, opens the definitive textbook on optimal stopping. And it's hard to think of a more concise description of the human condition. We decide the right time to buy stocks and the right time to sell them, sure, but also the right time to open the bottle of wine we've been keeping around for a special occasion, the right moment to interrupt someone, the right moment to kiss them. Viewed this way, the secretary problem's most fundamental yet most unbelievable assumption, its strict seriality, its inexorable one-way march, is revealed to be the nature of time itself. As such, the explicit premise of the optimal stopping problem is the implicit premise of what it is to be alive. It's this that forces us to decide based on possibilities we've not yet seen. This that forces us to embrace high rates of failure even when acting optimally. No choice recurs. We may get similar choices again, but never that exact one. Hesitation, inaction, is just as irrevocable as action. What the motorist locked on the one-way road is to space, we are to the fourth dimension. We truly pass this way but once. Intuitively, we think that rational decision-making means exhaustively enumerating our options, weighing each one carefully, and then selecting the best. But in practice, when the clock or the ticker is ticking, few aspects of decision-making or of thinking more generally are as important as this one: when to stop. 2. Explore, exploit. The latest versus the greatest. Your stomach rumbles. Do you go to the Italian restaurant that you know and love? Or the new Thai place that just opened up? Do you take your best friend or reach out to a new acquaintance you'd like to get to know better? This is too hard. Maybe you'll just stay home. Do you cook a recipe that you know is going to work or scour the internet for new inspiration? Never mind. How about you just order a pizza? Do you get your usual or ask about the specials? You're already exhausted before you get to the first bite. And the thought of putting on a record, watching a movie, or reading a book, which one? No longer seems quite so relaxing. Every day, we are constantly forced to make decisions between options that differ in a very specific dimension. Do we try new things or stick with our favorite ones? We intuitively understand that life is a balance between novelty and tradition, between the latest and the greatest, between taking risks and savoring what we know and love. But just as with the look or leap dilemma of the apartment hunt, the unanswered question is, what balance? In the 1974 classic Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, Robert Persig decries the conversational opener, "What's New?", arguing that the question, if pursued exclusively, results only in an endless parade of trivia and fashion, the silt of tomorrow. He endorses an alternative as vastly superior. What's best? But the reality is not so simple. Remembering that every best song and restaurant among your favorites began humbly as something merely new to you is a reminder that there may be yet unknown bests still out there, and thus that the new is indeed worthy of at least some of our attention. Age-worn aphorisms acknowledge this tension, but don't solve it. Make new friends, but keep the old. Those are silver, these are gold. And there is no life so rich and rare, but one more friend could enter there, are true enough, Certainly their scansion is unimpeachable. But they fail to tell us anything useful about the ratio of, say, silver and gold that makes the best alloy of a life well lived. Computer scientists have been working on finding this balance for more than 50 years. They even have a name for it, the explore-exploit trade-off. Explore-exploit. In English, the words explore and exploit come loaded with completely opposite connotations. But to a computer scientist, these words have much more specific and neutral meanings. Simply put, exploration is gathering information, and exploitation is using the information you have to get a known good result. It's fairly intuitive that never exploring is no way to live. But it's also worth mentioning that never exploiting can be every bit as bad. In the computer science definition, exploitation actually comes to characterize many of what we consider to be life's best moments. A family gathering together on the holidays is exploitation. So is a bookworm settling into a reading chair with a hot cup of coffee and a beloved favorite, or a band playing their greatest hits to a crowd of adoring fans, or a couple that has stood the test of time dancing to their song. What's more, exploration can be a curse. Part of what's nice about music, for instance, is that there are constantly new things to listen to. Or, if you're a music journalist, part of what's terrible about music is that there are constantly new things to listen to. Being a music journalist means turning the exploration dial all the way to 11, where it's nothing but new things all the time. Music lovers might imagine working in music journalism to be paradise, but when you constantly have to explore the new, you can never enjoy the fruits of your connoisseurship, a particular kind of hell. Few people know this experience as deeply as Scott Plogonoff, the former editor-in-chief of Pitchfork. "You try to find spaces when you're working to listen to something that you just want to listen to," he says of A Critic's Life. His desperate urges to stop wading through unheard tunes of dubious quality and just listen to what he loved were so strong that Plogonoff would put only new music on his iPod to make himself physically incapable of abandoning his duties in those moments when he just really, really, really wanted to listen to the Smiths. Journalists are martyrs, exploring so that others may exploit. In computer science, the tension between exploration and exploitation takes its most concrete form in a scenario called the multi-armed bandit problem. The odd name comes from the colloquial term for a casino slot machine, the one-armed bandit. Imagine walking into a casino full of different slot machines, each one with its own odds of a payoff. The rub, of course, is that you aren't told those odds in advance. Until you start playing, you won't have any idea which machines are the most lucrative, loose, as slot machine aficionados call it, and which ones are just money sinks. Naturally, you're interested in maximizing your total winnings. And it's clear that this is going to involve some combination of pulling the arms on different machines to test them out, exploring, and favoring the most promising machines you've found, exploiting. To get a sense for the problem's subtleties, imagine being faced with only two machines. One you've played a total of 15 times, 9 times it paid out and 6 times it didn't. The other you've played only twice, and it once paid out and once did not. Which is more promising? Simply dividing the wins by the total number of pulls will give you the machine's expected value, and by this method, the first machine clearly comes out ahead. Its 9-6 record makes for an expected value of 60%, whereas the second machine's 1-1 record yields an expected value of only 50%. But there's more to it than that. After all, just two pulls aren't really very many. So there's a sense in which we just don't yet know how good the second machine might actually be. Choosing a restaurant or an album is, in effect, a matter of deciding which arm to pull in life's casino. But understanding the explore-exploit trade-off isn't just a way to improve decisions about where to eat or what to listen to. It also provides fundamental insights into how our goals should change as we age, and why the most rational course of action isn't always trying to choose the best. And it turns out to be at the heart of, among other things, web design and clinical trials, two topics that normally aren't mentioned in the same sentence. People tend to treat decisions in isolation, to focus on finding each time the outcome with the highest expected value. But decisions are almost never isolated, and expected value isn't the end of the story. If you're thinking not just about the next decision, but about all the decisions you're going to make about the same options in the future, the explore-exploit trade-off is crucial to the process. In this way, writes mathematician Peter Whittle, the bandit problem embodies in essential form a conflict evident in all human action. So, which of those two arms should you pull? It's a trick question. It completely depends on something we haven't discussed yet: how long you plan to be in the casino. Seize the interval. Carpe diem, urges Robin Williams in one of the most memorable scenes of the 1989 film Dead Poets Society. Seize the day, boys. Make your lives extraordinary. It's incredibly important advice. It's also somewhat self-contradictory. Seizing a day and seizing a lifetime are two entirely different endeavors. We have the expression, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. But perhaps we should also have its inverse. Start learning a new language or an instrument, and make small talk with a stranger, because life is long, and who knows what joy could blossom over many years' time. When balancing favorite experiences and new ones, nothing matters as much as the interval over which we plan to enjoy them. I'm more likely to try a new restaurant when I move to a city than when I'm leaving it, explains data scientist and blogger Chris Stuccio, a veteran of grappling with the explore-exploit trade-off in both his work and his life. I mostly go to restaurants I know and love now, because I know I'm going to be leaving New York fairly soon. Whereas a couple years ago I moved to Pune, India, and I just would eat friggin' everywhere that didn't look like it was gonna kill me. And as I was leaving the city, I went back to all my old favorites, rather than trying out new stuff. Even if I find a slightly better place, I'm only going to go there once or twice, so why take the risk? A sobering property of trying new things is that the value of exploration, of finding a new favorite, can only go down over time as the remaining opportunities to savor it dwindle. Discovering an enchanting cafe on your last night in town doesn't give you the opportunity to return. The flip side is that the value of exploitation can only go up over time. The loveliest cafe that you know about today is, by definition, at least as lovely as the loveliest cafe you knew about last month. And if you've found another favorite since then, it might just be more so. So explore when you will have time to use the resulting knowledge. Exploit when you're ready to cash in. The interval makes the strategy. Interestingly, since the interval makes the strategy, then by observing the strategy, we can also infer the interval. Take Hollywood, for instance. Among the 10 highest-grossing movies of 1981, only two were sequels. In 1991, it was three. In 2001, it was five. And in 2011, eight of the top 10 highest-grossing films were sequels. In fact, 2011 set a record for the greatest percentage of sequels among major studio releases. Then 2012 immediately broke that record. The next year would break it again. In December 2012, journalist Nick Allen looked ahead with palpable fatigue to the year to come. Audiences will be given a sixth helping of X-Men, plus Fast and Furious 6, Die Hard 5, Scary Movie 5, and Paranormal Activity 5. There will also be Iron Man 3, The Hangover 3, and second outings for The Muppets, The Smurfs, G.I. Joe, and Bad Santa. From a studio's perspective, a sequel is a movie with a guaranteed fan base, a cash cow, a sure thing, an exploit. And an overload of sure things signals a short-termist approach, as with Stuccio on his way out of town. The sequels are more likely than brand new movies to be hits this year. But where will the beloved franchises of the future come from? Such a sequel deluge is not only lamentable, certainly critics think so, it's also somewhat poignant. By entering an almost purely exploit-focused phase, the film industry seems to be signaling a belief that it is near the end of its interval. A look into the economics of Hollywood confirms this hunch. Profits of the largest film studios declined by 40% between 2007 and 2011. And ticket sales have declined in 7 of the past 10 years. As The Economist puts it, squeezed between rising costs and falling revenues, the big studios have responded by trying to make more films they think will be hits, usually sequels, prequels, or anything featuring characters with name recognition. In other words, they're pulling the arms of the best machines they've got before the casino turns them out. Win, stay. Finding optimal algorithms that tell us exactly how to handle the multi-armed bandit problem has proven incredibly challenging. Indeed, as Peter Whittle recounts, during World War II, efforts to solve the question so sapped the energies and minds of Allied analysts that the suggestion was made that the problem be dropped over Germany as the ultimate instrument of intellectual sabotage. The first steps toward a solution were taken in the years after the war, when Columbia mathematician Herbert Robbins showed that there's a simple strategy that, while not perfect, comes with some nice guarantees. Robbins specifically considered the case where there are exactly two slot machines, and proposed a solution called the win-stay-lose-shift algorithm. Choose an arm at random and keep pulling it as long as it keeps paying off. If the arm doesn't pay off after a particular pull, then switch to the other one. Although this simple strategy is far from a complete solution, Robbins proved in 1952 that it performs reliably better than chance. Following Robbins, a series of papers examined the stay-on-a-winner principle further. Intuitively, if you were already willing to pull an arm, and it has just paid off, that should only increase your estimate of its value, and you should only be more willing to pull it again. And indeed, win-stay turns out to be an element of the optimal strategy for balancing exploration and exploitation under a wide range of conditions. But lose shift is another story. Changing arms each time one fails is a pretty rash move. Imagine going to a restaurant 100 times, each time having a wonderful meal. Would one disappointment be enough to induce you to give up on it? Good options shouldn't be penalized too strongly for being imperfect. More significantly, win, stay, lose, shift doesn't have any notion of the interval over which you are optimizing. If your favorite restaurant disappointed you the last time you ate there, that algorithm always says you should go to another place, even if it's your last night in town. Still, Robbins' initial work on the multi-armed bandit problem kicked off a substantial literature, and researchers made significant progress over the next few years. Richard Bellman, a mathematician at the Rand Corporation, found an exact solution to the problem for cases where we know in advance exactly how many options and opportunities we'll have in total. As with the full information secretary problem, Bellman's trick was essentially to work backward, starting by imagining the final pull and considering which slot machine to choose given all the possible outcomes of the previous decisions. Having figured that out, you'd then turn to the second-to-last opportunity, then the previous one, and the one before that, all the way back to the start. The answers that emerge from Bellman's method are ironclad, but with many options and a long casino visit, it can require a dizzying, or impossible, amount of work. What's more, even if we are able to calculate all possible futures, we of course don't always know exactly how many opportunities, or even how many options, we'll have. For these reasons, the multi-armed bandit problem effectively stayed unsolved. In Whittle's words, it quickly became a classic and a byword for intransigence. The Gittins Index. As so often happens in mathematics, though, the particular is the gateway to the universal. In the 1970s, the Unilever Corporation asked a young mathematician named John Gittins to help them optimize some of their drug trials. Unexpectedly, what they got was the answer to a mathematical riddle that had gone unsolved for a generation. Gittins, who is now a professor of statistics at Oxford, pondered the question posed by Unilever. Given several different chemical compounds, what is the quickest way to determine which compound is likely to be effective against a disease? Gittins tried to cast the problem in the most general form he could. Multiple options to pursue, a different probability of reward for each option, and a certain amount of effort or money or time to be allocated among them. It was, of course, another incarnation of the multi-armed bandit problem. Both the for-profit drug companies and the medical profession they serve are constantly faced with the competing demands of the explore-exploit trade-off. Companies want to invest R&D money into the discovery of new drugs, but also want to make sure their profitable current product lines are flourishing. Doctors want to prescribe the best existing treatments so that patients get the care they need, but also want to encourage experimental studies that may turn up even better ones. In both cases, notably, it's not entirely clear what the relevant interval ought to be. In a sense, drug companies and doctors alike are interested in the indefinite future. Companies want to be around, theoretically, forever. And on the medical side, a breakthrough could go on to help people who haven't even been born yet. Nonetheless, the present has a higher priority. A cured patient today is taken to be more valuable than one cured a week or a year from now. And certainly the same holds true of profits. Economists refer to this idea of valuing the present more highly than the future as discounting. Unlike previous researchers, Gittins approached the multi-armed bandit problem in those terms. He conceived the goal as maximizing payoffs not for a fixed interval of time, but for a future that is endless, yet discounted. Such discounting is not unfamiliar to us from our own lives. After all, if you visit a town for a 10-day vacation, then you should be making your restaurant decisions with a fixed interval in mind. But if you live in the town, this doesn't make as much sense. Instead, you might imagine the value of payoffs decreasing the further into the future they are. You care more about the meal you're going to eat tonight than the meal you're going to eat tomorrow, and more about tomorrow's meal than one a year from now. With the specifics of how much more, depending on your particular discount function. Gittins, for his part, made the assumption that the value assigned to payoffs decreases geometrically. That is, each restaurant visit you make is worth a constant fraction of the last one. If, let's say, you believe there is a 1% chance you'll get hit by a bus on any given day, then you should value tomorrow's dinner at 99% of the value of tonight's, if only because you might never get to eat it. Working with this geometric discounting assumption, Gittins investigated a strategy that he thought at least would be a pretty good approximation. To think about each arm of the multi-armed bandit separately from the others, and try to work out the value of that arm on its own. He did this by imagining something rather ingenious. A bribe. In the popular television game show Deal or No Deal, a contestant chooses one of 26 briefcases, which contain prizes ranging from a penny to $1 million. As the game progresses, a mysterious character called the Banker will periodically call in and offer the contestant various sums of money to not open the chosen briefcase. It's up to the contestant to decide at what price they're willing to take a sure thing over the uncertainty of the briefcase prize. Gittens, albeit many years before the first episode of Deal or No Deal aired, realized that the multi-armed bandit problem is no different. For every slot machine we know little or nothing about, there is some guaranteed payout rate which, if offered to us in lieu of that machine, will make us quite content never to pull its handle again. This number, which Gittens called the Dynamic Allocation Index, and which the world now knows as the Gittens Index, suggests an obvious strategy on the casino floor. Always play the arm with the highest index. In fact, the index strategy turned out to be more than a good approximation. It completely solves the multi-armed bandit with geometrically discounted payoffs. The tension between exploration and exploitation resolves into the simpler task of maximizing a single quantity that accounts for both. Gittens is modest about the achievement. It's not quite Fermat's last theorem, he says with a chuckle, but it's a theorem that put to rest a significant set of questions about the explore-exploit dilemma. Now, actually calculating the Gittens index for a specific machine, given its track record and our discounting rate, is still fairly involved. But once the Gittens index for a particular set of assumptions is known, it can be used for any problem of that form. Crucially, it doesn't even matter how many arms are involved, since the index for each arm is calculated separately. Assuming that a payoff on our next pull is worth 90% of a payoff now, these Gittens index values can be used to resolve a variety of everyday multi-armed bandit problems. For example, under these assumptions, you should, in fact, choose the slot machine that has a track record of 1-1 and an expected value of 50%, over the one with a track record of 9-6 and an expected value of 60%. Looking up the relevant Gittens index values shows that the lesser-known machine has an index of 0.6346, while the more-played machine scores only a 0.6300. Problem solved. Try your luck this time and explore. The Gittens index allows us to make a few other interesting observations. First, we can see the win-stay principle at work. If an arm is ever the correct one to pull, and that pull is a winner, then it can only make more sense to pull the same arm again. Second, we can see where lose shift would get us into trouble. Having 9 initial wins followed by a loss gets you an index of 0.8695, which is still higher than most. So you should probably stay with that arm for at least another pull. But perhaps the most interesting value is the one for a machine with a record of 0-0, one that's a complete unknown. This machine has an expected value of 0.5000, but a Gittens index of 0.7029. In other words, something you have no experience with whatsoever is nearly as attractive as a machine that you know pays out 7 times out of 10. As you gain more experience, a record of 1-1 yields an index of 0.6346. A record of 2-2 yields 0.6010, and so on. If such 50% successful performance persists, the index does ultimately converge on 0.5000, as experience confirms that the machine is indeed nothing special and takes away the bonus that spurs further exploration. But the convergence happens fairly slowly. The exploration bonus is a powerful force. Indeed, even a failure on the very first pull, producing a record of 0-1, makes for a Gittens index that's still above 50%. We can also see how the explore-exploit trade-off changes as we change the way we're discounting the future. If we assume that a payoff next time is worth 99% of one now rather than 90%, the value of making a chance discovery relative to taking a sure thing goes up even more. Here, a totally untested machine with a 0-0 record is worth a guaranteed 86.99% chance of a payout. The Gittins Index, then, provides a formal, rigorous justification for preferring the unknown, provided we have some opportunity to exploit the results of what we learn from exploring. The old adage tells us that the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. But the math tells us why. The unknown has a chance of being better, even if we actually expect it to be no different, or if it's just as likely to be worse. The untested rookie is worth more, early in the season anyway, than the veteran of seemingly equal ability, precisely because we know less about him. Exploration in itself has value, since trying new things increases our chances of finding the best. So taking the future into account, rather than focusing just on the present, drives us toward novelty. The Gittins Index thus provides an amazingly straightforward solution to the multi-armed bandit problem. But it doesn't necessarily close the book on the puzzle, or help us navigate all the explore-exploit trade-offs of everyday life. For one, the Gittins Index is optimal only under some strong assumptions. It's based on geometric discounting of future reward, valuing each pull at a constant fraction of the previous one, which is something that a variety of experiments in behavioral economics and psychology suggest people don't do. And if there's a cost to switching among options, the Gittins strategy is no longer optimal either. The grass on the other side of the fence may look a bit greener, but that doesn't necessarily warrant climbing the fence, let alone taking out a second mortgage. Perhaps even more importantly, it's hard to compute the Gittins Index on the fly. If you carry around a table of index values, you can optimize your dining choices, but the time and effort involved might not be worth it. Wait, I can resolve this argument. That restaurant was good 29 times out of 35, but this other one has been good 13 times out of 16, so the Gittins indices are, hey, where did everybody go? In the time since the development of the Gittins Index, such concerns have sent computer scientists and statisticians searching for simpler and more flexible strategies for dealing with multi-armed bandits. These strategies are easier for humans and machines to apply in a range of situations than crunching the optimal Gittins Index while still providing comparably good performance. They also engage with one of our biggest human fears regarding decisions about which chances to take. Regret and optimism. Regrets, I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. Frank Sinatra. For myself, I am an optimist. It does not seem to be much use being anything else. Winston Churchill. If the Gittins Index is too complicated, or if you're not in a situation well characterized by geometric discounting, then you have another option. Focus on regret. When we choose what to eat, who to spend time with, or what city to live in, regret looms large. Presented with a set of good options, it's easy to torture ourselves with the consequences of making the wrong choice. These regrets are often about the things we failed to do, the options we never tried. In the memorable words of management theorist Chester Barnard, to try and fail is at least to learn. To fail to try is to suffer the inestimable loss of what might have been. Regret can also be highly motivating. Before he decided to start Amazon.com, Jeff Bezos had a secure and well-paid position at the investment company D.E. Shaw & Company in New York. Starting an online bookstore in Seattle was going to be a big leap, something that his boss, that's D.E. Shaw, advised him to think about carefully. Says Bezos, "The framework I found, which made the decision incredibly easy, was what I called, what only a nerd would call, a regret minimization framework. So I wanted to project myself forward to age 80 and say, okay, now I'm looking back on my life. I want to have minimized the number of regrets I have. I knew that when I was 80, I was not going to regret having tried this. I was not going to regret trying to participate in this thing called the internet that I thought was going to be a really big deal. I knew that if I failed, I wouldn't regret that. But I knew the one thing I might regret is not ever having tried. I knew that that would haunt me every day, and so, when I thought about it that way, it was an incredibly easy decision. Computer science can't offer you a life with no regret, but it can, potentially, offer you just what Bezos was looking for, a life with minimal regret. Regret is the result of comparing what we actually did with what would have been best in hindsight. In A Multi-Armed Bandit, Barnard's inestimable loss can in fact be measured precisely, and regret assigned a number. It's the difference between the total payoff obtained by following a particular strategy and the total payoff that theoretically could have been obtained by just pulling the best arm every single time, had we only known from the start which one it was. We can calculate this number for different strategies and search for those that minimize it. In 1985, Herbert Robbins took a second shot at the multi-armed bandit problem, some 30 years after his initial work on Win Stay, Lose Shift. He and fellow Columbia mathematician Say Lung Lai were able to prove several key points about regret. First, assuming you're not omniscient, your total amount of regret will probably never stop increasing, even if you pick the best possible strategy. Because even the best strategy isn't perfect every time. Second, regret will increase at a slower rate if you pick the best strategy than if you pick others. What's more, with a good strategy, regret's rate of growth will go down over time as you learn more about the problem and are able to make better choices. Third, and most specifically, the minimum possible regret, again, assuming non-omniscience, is regret that increases at a logarithmic rate with every pull of the handle. Logarithmically increasing regret means that we'll make as many mistakes in our first 10 pulls as in the following 90, and as many in our first year as in the rest of the decade combined. The first decade's mistakes, in turn, are as many as we'll make for the rest of the century. That's some measure of consolation. In general, we can't realistically expect someday to never have any more regrets. But if we're following a regret-minimizing algorithm, every year we can expect to have fewer new regrets than we did the year before. Starting with Lai and Robbins, researchers in recent decades have set about looking for algorithms that offer the guarantee of minimal regret. Of the ones they've discovered, the most popular are known as upper confidence-bound algorithms. Visual displays of statistics often include so-called error bars that extend above and below any data point, indicating uncertainty in the measurement. The error bars show the range of plausible values that the quantity being measured could actually have. This range is known as the confidence interval. And as we gain more data about something, the confidence interval will shrink, reflecting an increasingly accurate assessment. For instance, a slot machine that has paid out once out of two pulls will have a wider confidence interval, though the same expected value, as a machine that has paid out five times on 10 pulls. In a multi-armed bandit problem, an upper confidence bound algorithm says, quite simply, to pick the option for which the top of the confidence interval is highest. Like the Gittins index, therefore, upper confidence bound algorithms assign a single number to each arm of the multi-armed bandit. And that number is set to the highest value that the arm could reasonably have, based on the information available so far. So an upper confidence bound algorithm doesn't care which arm has performed best so far. Instead, it chooses the arm that could reasonably perform best in the future. If you have never been to a restaurant before, for example, then for all you know, it could be great. Even if you have gone there once or twice and tried a couple of their dishes, you might not have enough information to rule out the possibility that it could yet prove better than your regular favorite. Like the Gittins index, the upper confidence bound is always greater than the expected value, but by less and less as we gain more experience with a particular option. A restaurant with a single mediocre review still retains a potential for greatness that's absent in a restaurant with hundreds of such reviews. The recommendations given by upper confidence bound algorithms will be similar to those provided by the Gittins index, but they are significantly easier to compute, and they don't require the assumption of geometric discounting. Upper confidence bound algorithms implement a principle that has been dubbed optimism in the face of uncertainty. Optimism, they show, can be perfectly rational. By focusing on the best that an option could be, given the evidence obtained so far, these algorithms give a boost to possibilities we know less about. As a consequence, they naturally inject a dose of exploration into the decision-making process, leaping at new options with enthusiasm, because any one of them could be the next big thing. The same principle has been used, for instance, by MIT's Leslie Kelbling, who builds optimistic robots that explore the space around them by boosting the value of uncharted terrain. And it clearly has implications for human lives as well. The success of upper confidence bound algorithms offers a formal justification for the benefit of the doubt. Following the advice of these algorithms, you should be excited to meet new people and try new things, to assume the best about them in the absence of evidence to the contrary. In the long run, optimism is the best prevention for regret. Bandits Online. In 2007, Google product manager Dan Seroker took a leave of absence to join the presidential campaign of then-Senator Barack Obama in Chicago. Heading the New Media Analytics team, Seroker brought one of Google's web practices to bear on the campaign's bright red donate button. The result was nothing short of astonishing. $57 million of additional donations were raised as a direct result of his work. What exactly did he do to that button? He A/B tested it. A/B testing works as follows. A company drafts several different versions of a particular web page. Perhaps they try different colors or images, or different headlines for a news article, or different arrangements of items on the screen. They then randomly assign incoming users to these various pages, usually in equal numbers. One user may see a red button, while another user may see a blue one. One may see donate, and another may see contribute. The relevant metrics, for instance, click-through rate or average revenue per visitor, are then monitored. After a period of time, if statistically significant effects are observed, the winning version is typically locked into place or becomes the control for another round of experiments. In the case of Obama's donation page, Seroker's A/B tests were revealing. For first-time visitors to the campaign site, a donate and get a gift button turned out to be the best performer, even after the cost of sending the gifts was taken into account. For longtime newsletter subscribers who had never given money, please donate worked the best, perhaps appealing to their guilt. For visitors who had already donated in the past, contribute worked best at securing follow-up donations, the logic being perhaps that the person had already donated but could always contribute more. And in all cases, to the astonishment of the campaign team, a simple black and white photo of the Obama family outperformed any other photo or video the team could come up with. The net effect of all of these independent optimizations